The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The long and ballyhooed trek of migrants from south of Mexico have reached their destination, almost. At the U.S. border, reality is setting in, even with the liberal media.
From what we've seen, the majority are actually men, and some of these men have not articulated that need for asylum.
Meanwhile, Russia's provocations towards Ukraine are poking a stick in NATO's face.
It's quite clear Russian forces fired at and inflicted casualties upon the Ukrainian Navy, and they're currently holding 23 sailors captive, at least three of whom are wounded.
And a highly anticipated U.S. intergovernmental report on climate is out, but some in the academic scientific community aren't buying. We'll hear from Bjorn Lomborg.
They claim that damage costs could go as high as 10% U.S. GDP by the end of the century.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, on demand 24/7, and learn more at hughhewitt.com. The so-called caravan of migrants from countries on Mexico's southern border, like Honduras and Guatemala, is now here on our border. What the Trump administration has been preparing for has come to pass. Violence also broke out, and the U.S. military and border guards have been pummeled by rocks and bottles, in some cases responding with tear gas. Initially, our media had no problems with the caravan, but many had big issues with the administration's refusal to welcome them, no questions asked. Now it appears that some of the mainstream media, even some of my colleagues at MSNBC, are looking askance, or at least altering their messaging. Here's my Salem colleague Mike Gallagher interacting with the media frenzy taking place.
There's a lot of people going nuts over this issue. And of course, the reason they're going nuts is because they're losing the narrative. They're losing control of the narrative. The narrative is that the people along that are trying to come into the United States are just poor, disadvantaged women and children in strollers wearing diapers. And of course, they just want a better life. They just want jobs, you know, the jobs that no American will take. That's the narrative. And that's all fallen apart. I want you to hear this reporter, Yadi Schwartz, who's an MSNBC reporter. And they toss to this reporter, and there's, you know, MSNBC, it's just the poor little old ladies and the children in strollers. And look at that. They're tear gassing the children. It's terrible.
Right. And it's very difficult because this has become such a polarizing issue. If we kind of take a walk, you'll be able to see for yourself. Again, this is the inner sanctum of the shelter. So you're going to see a lot of families here, a lot of women and children. But the truth is the majority of the people that are part of this caravan, especially outside, if we can make our way all the way over there, we'll show you the majority of them are men. So when this becomes a polarized political issue in the United States, you have people on one side that point and say there are women and children here, and that is true. And then there are others who point and say these are men that are trying to cross the border, and that's true too. From what we've seen, the majority are actually men, and some of these men have not articulated that need for asylum. Instead, they have talked about, you know, going to the United States for a better life and to find work.
Nothing screams seeking asylum better than throwing rocks and bricks at police and Border Patrol agents. But it was just too much for Geraldo to bear. Here he is yesterday on Fox News Channel's The Five.
We suspend our humanity when it comes to this issue, and I fear that it is because they look different than the Geraldo.
There it is. They look different than Americans. Incidentally, you understand the two issues that have been conflated, right? They're supposed to be seeking asylum. They are refugees from oppressive countries. Well, that is a heck of a lot different than they want a better life and they want to deliver our pizzas. What's the humane response? If you're a Mexican police officer or a U.S. Border Patrol agent entrusted with securing the border, how are you supposed to humanely respond to having a rock thrown at your head?
Is this crowd going to be processed as refugees seeking asylum or turned away? A federal judge in San Francisco stepped in, blocking President Trump's executive order creating a structure for processing legitimate asylum applicants. Here's my Salem Network colleague, Larry Elder, seeking constitutional expertise from one of the best, my longtime colleague at the Chapman University's Fowler School of Law, John Eastman.
Professor, since the judge has entered this restraining order so that this executive order cannot go forward, so all the people now who are on the border, who are coming here, whether they come illegally, whether they come over the wall, whether they come through an official port of entry, automatically those claims have to be considered, and we're going to release them into the interior of the country.
That's right, because there are other rules that have already shut down the statutory authority for expedited review. Mm-hmm. What the judges are doing here is creating huge loopholes to our national security and the authority that the Congress expressly gave the president to control our borders.
Professor, I've heard two very different things about how often people who want to apply for asylum, in fact, show up. President Trump said only about 9 or 10% ever show up for their court date. I've heard 90% show up for their court date. What's the truth?
Well, yeah, the ACLU's lawsuit claims that 90% show up for the court date, but that's only looking at a very small subset of people who have legitimate asylum claims. Guess what? They're going to show up because as soon as they've got their legitimate claim pressed, they get not only authorization to stay in the United States, but they get a path to citizenship. But if you don't have if your claim for asylum was specious, and there are very specific rules on who's eligible for asylum. People just wanting to seek a different life here, the economies are bad in their country, are not eligible for asylum on refugee status. Mm-hmm. Asylum and refugee status is very limited to people who have already been prosecuted or have a legitimate fear of being, targeted for because of their race or religion or ethnic background political party views, those things. Just wanting to move to the United States from Guatemala doesn't qualify you for asylum. And the numbers there of people that are, given this expedited review and then released into the country to actually show up for their removal proceedings where they're supposed to raise in due course their asylum claims, the percentage of people that don't show up for those is huge.
In Eastern Europe, we're watching a familiar scene of Russian aggression, this time in the Kerch Strait, which provides access to key Ukrainian ports. Three small Ukrainian ships passing through this disputed strait were fired on by the Russians, injuring several Ukrainian sailors and taking them captive. I spoke with my reliable source on military and foreign relations, Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher, shortly following the incident. Let's talk about two things, the INF and the Ukraine-Russia incident. The president told the Washington Post yesterday that he was going to be brief last night on the Ukraine-Russia incident at sea and that they might not meet with Putin. If he asked Mike Gallagher's opinion, ought he to meet with Putin at the G20?
Don't meet with Putin, because once again, Putin is telling us who he is. Despite a 2003 agreement to exercise joint oversight of the Kerch Strait with Ukraine, it's quite clear Russian forces fired at and inflicted casualties upon the Ukrainian Navy. They seized three Ukrainian ships, two gunboats, and a tug, and are currently holding 23 sailors captive, at least three of whom are wounded. And so I was glad to see both Ambassador Haley and NATO come out with strong statements condemning the attack. But words alone will not be a sufficient response, and I think the president can send an even stronger response. And it's important to recognize that Kerch is not only a tinderbox, it's a vitally important strategic passage. It commands the route from the Black Sea into the Sea of Azov, with Russian-occupied Crimea to its west and Russia to its east. And free access to the strait is vital to the Ukrainian economy because it connects its manufacturing-heavy southeast through the Sea of Azov to shipping lanes throughout Europe and Asia. So this is a very delicate and combustible situation, and it's going to require presidential leadership.
Now, it also has a presidential value in the South China Sea. A lot of people, Russia is its own rogue regime acting like a bully, and they've massed troops on the Ukrainian border, and we have to ask you about whether or not NATO should get involved there with more people circulating through Ukraine. But if Russia can do this in the Sea of Azov, in these straits, then China can do it in the South China Sea, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think, as you allude to, these are connected, right? If our adversaries test and shatter our resolve in one arena of geopolitical competition, then other adversaries and competitors will take note of that and then will continue to probe, right? We've talked about how Putin operates under the Leninist adage of you probe with bayonets, and if you find mush, you push, you find steel, you stop. And so this is just yet another example why weakness in one domain translates into risk in another domain.
So what should, in your opinion, NATO do, and that would include the United States, vis-a-vis Ukraine, to indicate that there's steel on that border in eastern Ukraine, not mush?
Well, I think we can continue to impose painful costs on Putin's regime and his closest supporters in order to prove that we have Ukraine's back. We should continue lethal assistance to Ukraine, including Javelin anti-tank missiles, and we should carefully study other weapons we might want to provide to Kyiv. And finally, the NDAA this year actually provided the authority to conduct retaliatory cyber attacks against Russia, along with China, North Korea, and Iran, if we are facing an active, systematic, and ongoing campaign of attack against us in cyberspace. And from what we know in public reporting, there's certainly an argument that Russia meets that bar, and consequently, I think it's worth thinking through appropriate and proportional measures. Beyond that, I think we should be looking seriously, as we directed the administration to do in the NDAA, at Poland's offer to permanently house a brigade combat team.
We're going to have to slow down for the Steelers fan. The NDAA is the National Defense Authorization Act. An AUMF is an authorization for the use of military force. In this year's, in the 2019 NDAA, there was included a new AUMF concerning cyber weapons and retaliation. But Angus King on this show, you have to go back and read the transcript, said, oh, it doesn't reach Russia. It doesn't, that it wouldn't cover this. This is, that's not. So how did you read the AUMF with regard to general Russian hostility in something like the Sea of Azov? Does it give us some, does it give the administration authority it did not have vis-a-vis situations like this one?
Yeah, I might read it, however, a little bit differently. And I think this is maybe a separate thing than the Sea of Azov, because as I read the NDAA, and I'd have to go back to the exact language, it would have to be a cyber attack against us. And how it's defined in the NDAA is an active, systematic, ongoing campaign of attack against us in cyberspace.
Let me ask you, if they are flooding our websites with bots to attack Ukraine's legitimacy and to do the Russian TV stuff of making propaganda into news and delegitimizing Ukraine, do you think that would qualify under the AUMF in the NDAA?
I do. I think it would allow us to respond proportionally with our own measures to disrupt them. And I think we need to be thinking more creatively about how we recruit the requisite personnel to engage in that business. It would be interesting to explore the idea of letters of mark and reprisal for cyber actors to work on our behalf, which is an idea that's been percolating among various people. It may sound silly to some.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
you have to believe all three things. The world is heating up. The world is heating up almost entirely because of reasons having to do with human behavior. And it's going to lead to worldwide catastrophe. So if you believe the world is heating up, that's not enough. You're still a denier. You have to believe it's catastrophe and caused by humans.
The climate conversation heats up when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. This past week saw the publication of the, quote, Fourth National Climate Assessment, close quote, published by the U.S. federal government. The product of the combined agencies of our federal government immediately drew comment in both the scientific and political worlds. The Trump administration immediately referred to the document as radical and not based on facts. My friend and Salem colleague Dennis Prager used the occasion to showcase a meet the press debate.
The left has really succeeded, but so it drives them crazy when they don't fully succeed. I mean, Donald Trump is their nightmare. But anybody who doesn't believe remember, you have to believe all three things. The world is heating up. The world is heating up almost entirely because of anthropocentric reasons. That is, reasons having to do with human behavior,
and it's going to lead to worldwide catastrophe. You have to believe it's catastrophe and caused by humans. Can't be anything else. Can't be because of cycles of weather that have gone on all through history. Oh, God, what I'm asked to believe. So this went on and we meet the press. So let's get the players clear for my listeners here about what voices they will be hearing. The first voice is this woman from the American Enterprise Institute. Her name is Danielle Plutkett. Okay, let's hear her.
We need to also recognize that we just had two of the coldest years, the biggest drop in global temperatures.
To bring in any dissenting fact, not opinion, dissenting fact, is intolerable. It's amazing that they had her on. Go on.
We don't talk about that because it's not part of the agenda. The United States has been dropping in CO2 emissions since we pulled out of Paris. There are actually good things that are happening. We are not using dirty coal anymore. It's the Europeans who are using dirty coal. There actually is some corporate leadership on this. Yes, we need to deal with these problems. Yes, we need to mitigate the things we see, but we shouldn't be hysterical.
Helene, it does seem as if there's actually more corporate interest in doing something than there is government interest.
Yeah, it's just the problem is it's not the corporation.
All right, hold on. Helene Cooper is with the New York Hysterical Times. Okay.
Yeah, it's just the problem is it's not the corporations that are polluting the most. And I actually think
wait, so who is? Who is? It's not even an argument. I don't know who she's referring to. It's not corporations who are polluting the most. Rather, it is. She doesn't say. Okay, all right, go on.
And I actually think we should be hysterical. I'm going to disagree with you on this.
Yeah.
I think anybody who...
By the way, wait, forgive me. I'm sorry, Helene, for interrupting you. You think we should be hysterical. Well, you are. The whole left is hysterical. It's hysterical about everything. It's hysterical about racism and misogyny in America. There is no cause about which the left is not hysterical. Hysteria is leftism. Go on.
I think anybody who has children or anybody who can imagine having children and grandchildren, how can you look at them and think this is the kind of world that through our own inaction and our inability to do something that we're going to leave them? I think I'm really glad.
Okay, so here is what. All right, guys. So this is what I tell my children and grandchildren. Okay, Helene? So since you addressed it to people, how could you look them in the eye? Okay, so here you go. I want my grandchildren to say, Poppy fought evil, not carbon emissions. Okay? So I'm telling you, that's my grandchildren call me Poppy. My son calls me Dad. My sons. But he's the father of the grandchildren, so I was thinking of him. Both my sons call me Dad. Actually, one calls me Pops. And my grandchildren call me Poppy. So I hereby announce I will look them in the eye and they will be able to say, this is what Poppy said, fight evil, not carbon emissions. All right? That's a much greater threat to humanity.
Climate change has major economic implications and governments around the world are paying close attention. Denmark's Bjorn Lomborg, sometimes referred to as one of the best known global warming skeptics, looks at climate science from a socioeconomic perspective. Shortly after the assessment's publication, Lomborg was a guest of my colleague, Michael Medved.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says we are all at risk of premature death through climate change unless we act dramatically and immediately, to which you say...
That's just simply incredible exaggeration. There is a problem. This is totally out of the of anything reasonable. To say that kind of thing.
What about this statistic that has come up that says that it's going to be a devastating blow to the U.S. economy over the next 50 years if we don't curb greenhouse gases? Do you buy that argument that's been basically endorsed by the U.S. government now?
Well, yes. So if you look at where this comes from, it's in the very back of the report. They claim that the damage cost could go as high as 10% of U.S. GDP by the end of the century. But there's a number of things that you need to realize before you buy into this. First of all, the methodology that is being used for this estimate is incredibly dodgy. It's not related to the well-established climate economics studies of what are the cost benefits of climate change. And for the world, it estimates wildly different numbers than what the established literature does. Just to give you a sense, at sort of 8 or 9 degrees Fahrenheit temperature increase, it estimates that the world will lose about 23% of its GDP. The established literature estimates about a fifth of that, or about 5%. And it runs on some really strange assumptions, which actually shows up because they say if you have it hotter, you will grow less. If you have it cooler, you'll grow more. So actually, they find that the two richest countries in the world will be two very cool countries. One will be Iceland, which will be by far the richest country per capita in the world. And the second richest is going to be Mongolia, which right now is about 4% of what the U.S. is. But by 2100, because of climate change, will actually be four times richer than the U.S. It's really hard to believe these sorts of numbers. This does not mean that there's no problem, but it means it's vastly exaggerated and not really helpful to make a good conversation about how we tackle global warming.
Where is this coming from? Where's the alarmism coming from in the government?
Fundamentally, what we're expecting is that because of the economic growth, pretty much everyone across the world is going to be much richer by the end of the century. The U.S. is probably going to be, say, 300% richer. And then you say, but 10% less rich. Now, that's not an unreasonable amount. That's a significant amount. But it still means the U.S. and each individual in the U.S. will be much, much richer. And that's important to recognize, that we're talking about a change of a much, much larger income. And then there is a global warming issue. It will make you slightly less well off than you would otherwise have been. You'll be phenomenally much better off, but you'll be slightly less well better off by the end of the century.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. To hear Michael's complete interview with Bjorn Lomborg, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
You would think, since they were rescued by the government, since they got that huge tax cut, they would be doing better than this.
The shutdown of the GM plant in Lordstown, Ohio, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. One of the key factors in President Trump's 2016 election victory was the working class vote for him. Those voters came out in large numbers from what used to be called the Rust Belt, places like Lordstown, Ohio, right next to my hometown of Warren, Ohio. In Lordstown, the primary employer is General Motors, where GM's Chevy Cruze passenger car is assembled. Despite government funding in the billions, maybe close to $50 billion in the form of bailouts and tax incentives, bankruptcy financing, GM just announced closures that will impact nearly 15,000 workers and shutter Lordstown. Is GM lacking in gratefulness to the government and the citizens of the United States? I turn to my friend and colleague at MSNBC business reporter Stephanie Ruhle. We start our conversation with a clip from Trump economic advisor Larry Kudlow.
I met with Mary Barra yesterday, and we had a lengthy conversation about the layoffs, the cause of the layoffs. It's a great disappointment, obviously. The president indicated his own disappointment. He believes, as frankly the Prime Minister of Canada, Trudeau, believes, that the USMCA deal was a great help to the automobile industry and to auto workers. And by the way, they made those statements separately. And yet, GM comes in right after the deal. By the way, that deal will be signed in Argentina with the U.S. And Canadian representatives. So there's great disappointment there. There's disappointment that it seems like GM would rather build its electric cars in China rather than in the United States.
That is Larry Kudlow voicing what I believe. I'm Hugh Hewitt in the ReliefFactor.com studio, but I'm a homer. Lordstown is where I grew up. I know most of the people have worked at that plant my entire life. I went to school with their kids. They're my teachers would work there in the summer. Stephanie, GM got $13 billion in TARP assistance. They got $33 billion debtor-in-possession financing. They got a jam down on their bondholders, and then they put the knife in the back of Lordstown. Am I right to be angry?
You're right to be angry and frustrated, but here's the issue. GM isn't beholden to the government. Mary Barra's job, and I'm not saying she's doing a good job or a bad job, but her job is to optimize the operations of her company, is to get as many people to buy GM cars as possible, and to do well by her shareholders. So, yes, you would think, since they were rescued by the government, since they get the amount of support they do, since they got that huge tax cut, they would be doing better than this and not have cuts that would be so damaging, devastating to those cities. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And when the president gave that massive tax cut, there wasn't a caveat, you must do this, you must do that. If it isn't working for the company, we are living in a free market, this is what they are allowed to do. What worries me is, who's then responsible for all those people? When they built that factory in Detroit in 1980, the government used eminent domain to mow down houses, churches, and schools so they could build that huge GM plant, the whole town. So here we are 40 years later. Those houses won't be able to sell. There will be nothing there. Whose responsibility is it to fix that? Because GM makes that announcement and the stock goes up. Mary Barra, we don't know what her fate is, but even if she's doing poorly and loses her job, she'll get a great package to leave, and they'll pay more money for a CEO. The disparity between CEO pay and worker pay has never been greater, and that worker is suffering. This flavor capitalism, this is a perfect example. It ain't working.
Well, generally, I believe in the free market, and it raises everyone out of poverty. But if a company becomes dependent upon the government for their survival, and then they turn around and bite the hand that feeds them, here's how the market will respond. I don't think people will buy GM trucks and SUVs, Stephanie. I think they will be mad at GM for closing their signal plant in Lordstown. I think they will simply reject GM products. That is such a horrific decision not to recognize the real world consequences, like the First Man movie. They left the planting of the flag off on the moon. The movie tanked. If your GM bites the hand that had fed it in the crisis, American consumers are going to respond like American consumers. Screw you. And that's the free market.
You may be right. I just don't know that GM had that much of a choice to make. If those factories are failing, if those cars aren't selling, this is about a failed business strategy. They failed in terms of business strategy, and now this is the decision they're making. They could have a huge blowback in terms of people who don't want to buy GM vehicles. That's an absolute consequence. But as far as what Mary Barra had to do, technically, she's not beholden to the government, and she doesn't owe President Trump anything. He's in a bit of a situation because he said, in good faith, to all those people in car country, you will not have to sell your home. We're going to bring those factories back. Unfortunately, what he's realizing is he doesn't have control of that.
But GM screwed not just Trump. They screwed Obama and Bush. They had deals with three presidents. All of them had deals with GM. And GM, if that is their level of leadership, then there is no new GM. It's as bad as the old GM.
Then a separate conversation is GM isn't run properly. GM should have different management.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
These are by far the most left-wing figures we've ever seen leading the British Labour Party.
Our close ally is bolting towards socialism. When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. If you're concerned about our government leaning towards socialism when you look at some of the congressional newbies soon to take office, consider Great Britain. Following years of Conservative Party leadership, it appears that the Labour Party is now favored for a takeover in the 2019 general elections. Weaknesses politically and economically, largely blamed on Conservative Party leadership, have opened the door for Labour Party ascendancy in 2019. This would place Labour Party leader and avowed socialist Jeremy Corbyn at the helm of our closest ally, which, Dennis Prager says, should greatly concern us. Here's Dennis with Nigel Farage, the former leader of the UKIP party, now a broadcaster and a political analyst.
What is happening in England now is if you want to be scared, and I don't believe in scares as a general rule, if you want to be scared, however, there is reason to be scared about the next British election. About the mishandling of Brexit, the British people voted. They voted to leave the EU, the European Union, because they wanted to actually maintain their independence. The left has utter contempt for nationalism, as you now see. Only a leftist can think it is profound. Only the New York Times can think that Macron, the president of France, saying nationalism is terrible, it's brought us great evil, but patriotism is beautiful. There is no difference that I understand between patriotism and nationalism. People have tried to explain that to me. It's nonsense. But the belief in nonsense is very deep. So, Nigel, welcome back to my life.
Thank you, Dennis, very much indeed.
Okay, my friend. There are two big issues here. Theodore Dalrymple, the British psychiatrist, wrote a devastating piece on what might happen if Labour wins. Even I was stunned. The language used by the Labour Party leaders is the same language the Soviets used to justify communism. And Dalrymple is not a flamethrower. You know, he's a medical doctor who writes about life. Is that accurate?
Well, here we've got in Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, and his sidekick, the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell. I mean, these are by far the most left-wing figures we've ever seen leading the British Labour Party. And they are absolutely committed to a form of government that literally uses Marxist language. Indeed, John McDonnell, at the dispatch box in the House of Commons a couple of years ago, when he responded to the budget, actually produced Mao's Little Red Book. I mean, this is extraordinary. These people are way left, very dangerous. What has come with them has been a wave of anti-Semitism right throughout the Labour Party that is deeply unpleasant and quite extraordinary that we should be seeing it, you know, in Europe 75 years after the Holocaust. And I'm very concerned what they would do to our society, very worried what they would do to our economy. Yes, it's a very, very worrying prospect. And yet, there are some quite large swathes of our youth that suddenly find socialism very attractive. And I think the reason is they've never actually lived under it. I have, Dennis. I lived here during the 1970s when the top income rate tax was 83% on earned income and 98% on unearned income. I've lived under hard left socialism, and that's the reason Mrs. Thatcher got in as a reaction to it. But these people are way to the left of the 70s socialism that I grew up under.
You cited John McDonnell, who would be Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is second in command in Britain. This is from Dalrymple. Only 5 years ago, he said that the historical figures he most admired were Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky. Did you know that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, McDonnell is an absolutely committed Marxist. Corbyn is a hard leftist, doesn't self-identify as a Marxist. But, I mean, normally, you know, you call people Marxists, and you do it as a pejorative term in debate. McDonnell self-identifies as one. And the problem we've got is that in the face of such extremism, despite the fact many of the young find some of these ideas attractive at the moment, the real problem we've got is, of course, this Conservative government is being led through the Brexit process by Theresa May so ineptly and so badly that they are beginning to open the door for this form of Marxism.
Why does the Conservative Party choose inept leaders?
It seems very good at doing so, doesn't it? I guess because, like most political parties, it has different wings, and it seeks a compromise candidate. But it also, Dennis, and this may sound a bit cynical, but it also seeks a candidate that gets a bit of support from mainstream media and, crucially, from many of the big global businesses. And that is why you have this bizarre situation where a conservative vote in the country is on the centre-right, and yet leader after leader comes from the centre-left.
Exactly. So I should not have used the word inept. I should use the word non-conservative. The Conservative Party does not produce conservative leaders.
That is absolutely wholly accurate, and I think that Cameron certainly represented more a form of social democracy. And Mrs. May, you know, she seems to be obsessed with minority rights. I'm not arguing minorities shouldn't have rights, but she seems to be obsessed with, you know, various different group interests. But worst of all, you know, what she's done is on the table before us right now, we have a withdrawal agreement from the European Union that basically represents nothing more than Brexit in name only. And, you know, it's not determined yet. It hasn't passed through the House of Commons, and I believe that it will fail. But at the moment, there are millions of Conservatives in this country who are saying, we are so disgusted with what Mrs. May has done, we will not vote Conservative. And if you say to them, well, what about the prospect of a Marxist getting in? They just say, I don't care. And that's because if you betray people's trust, it's very difficult just to point at the other guy and say he's a bad one and expect people to go on supporting. So, quite honestly, we are at a moment here in British politics of very, very real crisis. Brexit was something that the public voted for, but our political class simply can't accept. So we are going through very, very turbulent times.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Find Dennis's entire interview with Nigel Farage on townhallreview.com. Coming up,
the opioid crisis and any addiction crisis. It used to be just alcohol. It's everything now.
Being there for the downtrodden and the addicted. When the final segment of the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Salvation Army was established in London, England in 1865 by William and Catherine Booth. Now the Army is a worldwide organization and easily recognized during Christmas season by bell ringers and red kettles in shopping areas. But that's not the only place they are seen. The disasters that have visited our country during the past year, floods, fires, hurricanes, the ongoing rise of homelessness, the ongoing opioid epidemic, have shown us Salvation Army workers doing what they do best. As part of my annual build-up to Christmas, I invited Lieutenant Colonel Ward Matthews of the Salvation Army to be my guest on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Anyone this winter who sees Beautiful Boy, or who sees Ben is Back, or who sees the Mule, is going to come face-to-face with the reality of addiction in America to opioids and to crystal meth and the rise of K2 and all the other stuff. And you folks will work with anyone, will you not?
That's exactly right. We have rehab centers all across the country. Admission is free. We only have the only limits the number of beds in the facilities. But it seems that this topic is huge on the thoughts of all Americans. The opioid crisis and any addiction crisis. It used to be just alcohol. It's everything now.
I went down and talked at a Salvation Army event in Mississippi many years ago, and I was sitting next to a major who said some of the men go through the program 8 or 9 times. They were singing in a chorus. And you never give up. That's what makes the Salvation Army the Salvation Army. You never give up.
Well, it's a wonderful miracle to see someone who has been allowed to come back time after time finally break through and kick the addiction.
Now, talk to us a little bit as well about just providing Christmas for children. Tell us about that.
Well, the Christmas campaign and the donations which we get from it are used right in the communities in which they're raised. And the Salvation Army asks that everyone consider making a little extra gift this Christmas. One of the big secrets, Hugh, is that many of the programs the Salvation Army has are homelessness issues. And the truth is, a mom in financial distress loves her kids every bit as much as a mom who is well off. And so, but they don't have the funds to have a Merry Christmas. And what we do is we say, we have wonderful volunteers who will help your child at Christmas time. You save your money and pay the light bill, pay the heat bill, and stay right where you're living. And so the Christmas gift program, whether it's the Angel Tree program or anything else run by the Salvation Army, is designed to keep people at home and to share the joy of the season.
That is, it's remarkable. It's terrific. And people by the millions throw dollars into the kettle. But we've learned that kettles are not as widely available as they used to be. There are a lot of reasons for that, but they become online. And this is where the tradition continues. I don't know. How many years we've been doing this, Colonel? 10, 7? I don't know. We've been doing this a long time.
Yeah, just this portion, we've been doing it for at least that long. And when you think that it's a tradition that started 128 years ago and is still growing, that's a special thing. That's a part of the tradition of Christmas.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann, producers Charlie Richard, David Posey, and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne the Meteorologist Patterson. Let me say once again thanks to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for listening to us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.